Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
I have Hung from Lu Dang on with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me, Kenneth. Pleasure to be with you.
You've had a really long journey in the fashion industry. And want to go back to sort of your childhood, where you grew up and how you got into fashion.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long and interesting story. I was born in Rockville, Maryland. My parents they went to university towards the end of the war. And my grandfather was actually Dai Su. He was the ambassador between Vietnam and America towards during the war. So we always had roots in that East Coast, Washington, D.C. area. And typical first generation Vietnamese born in America, that dual life between rich Asian community, Vietnamese community on the weekends, and then white American upbringing in school. I think the link towards fashion happened a lot later. I can't say that I was really influenced by Vietnamese culture or that kind of fashion. I really got into fashion more in my teenage years, and it was more through a lens of I guess the way that I always relate my experience and introduction to fashion was in high school, walking down the hallway was that was my fashion show. So it was baggy jeans, concert tee, and it was really, I guess if I related back to my experience, it was like being in a high school where I was a minority. I wasn't the most outgoing kid. I knew I wasn't Asian American club. I wasn't really good in math, and I wasn't, that typical stereotypical idea of what an Asian kid was supposed to be like. But for me, I couldn't express myself through words. So fashion was really a way of me to express my identity.
When you say you couldn't really express yourself through words, do you mean that literally?
No, I mean, it's I don't know, in this attention getting, I don't know, I don't want to break everything down to race, but I feel growing up in America in the 80s, there was definitely hierarchies, right? We talk about Asians being the model minority in America, work hard, excel in school, shut the fuck up. And sorry if I'm cursing on your
mouth. No,
that's totally okay. But stay in your lane and behave, right? And for me, that was something I didn't really identify with. So for me, fashion was a way of speaking out, when I say I didn't have the words, it was more I wasn't outgoing. I didn't have the energy to be the captain of the football team, or, falling into these that rebellious rocker kid. I could more embody the codes and speak through nonverbal communication of dress.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you said that you started to kind of express yourself in the hallways at high school, but was fashion, the fashion trajectory for you, something that was starting to kind of get into your mind in the early days in high school? Or did you think about like another career?
You know, a good Asian son, I have a degree in computer science. I'm full disclosure, I'm a computer engineer because my parents thought fashion was a whim, that I could not succeed and that it was not for me. And I had to get a degree in computer science before I did fashion. And I mean, bless my parents. They've supported me through so much. And it's just a common story. I think growing up for me, there was always like the noble things to be were a doctor, a lawyer, or I guess an engineer, right? And those were the safe kind of positions of when I was a kid growing up, of like, okay, that's honorable. That's something that's, you know, prestigious in a way. Fashion, art, you know, anything in front of the camera was like, oh, that's too risky. That's standing out too much. We're more kind of behind the scenes. We're more hardworking kind of people. I mean, if we talk about inspirations around when I was growing up, there was definitely like, I call it immigrant flavor, you know, like for a long time I was embarrassed of it, you know, but for a long time I didn't want to identify as being Asian. I often chose being American before being Asian. But now that I look back, like Asian culture is so rich with flavor. If you look at the foods, it's like spicy, sweet, salty. There's so much flavor and richness. If you look at the people, there's so much flavor in kind of the style, you know, like in kind of the codes. And those were the seeds that were planted kind of for me very early on, you know, because of this idea of model minority in America. There were a lot of dodgy uncles around me, you know, there were bookies, there was kind of this, you know, drink too much, go out, kind of like because that alpha male wasn't allowed to kind of rise up, it had to go into darker, seedier angles. And that's the flavor that kind of interests me in my work today.
That's interesting you say alpha males were not really allowed to rise up. Can you go into that a little bit more?
Okay. So if you think about like the original trajectory, us as men were probably supposed to be kind of in Vietnam, right? Like considering there's no political turmoil, considering there's no colonization, like there's not necessarily the need for us, for my parents' generation, to have immigrated to Vietnam, right? So you're working within a demographic where there's much more opportunity to be different versions of yourself. So forced immigration, you know, like different political agendas taking over kind of Vietnam forced my parents' generation to kind of flee their homeland, right? So being a minority in America allowed for less space for masculine energy in America, in my point of view, right? So a lot of my parents' generation, the men that were doctors, lawyers, you know, prominent men, educated men, had to become taxi drivers, had to become dry clean owners, had to run restaurants. And this wasn't because of merit. This was because of inequality and a very real hierarchy of race in the 80s in America, right? And bless them, they worked hard. They made lives for themselves. They made lives for their kids. But I'm not going to sit here and say that he was equal. So because there was not space in that time for there to be strong Asian men, strong Asian men went other places in my mind to have their space.
I mean, I can make an argument that...
Please.
Yeah, that it's continuing today almost. I think the masculation of Asian men is something that I live with. I think that it's affected my self-esteem. It's affected my confidence. And I think that I'm still dealing with a lot of that. And I think that if I'm living with that as a 50-year-old man today, and I haven't really, you know, some people might argue with me, but I feel like I haven't really grown past, you know, that history that you're talking about. It's crazy. We're going to be talking about fashion, but I mean, this is all within the realm of what artists like you think about. I mean, this is something that is, I don't know if you've worked on it or you've cured it, quote unquote, but I'm curious to think in this day and age, we still don't really see it, not in the media, not in the surrounding, you know, quote unquote, alpha men that we are looking for in our lives. What's your thoughts on all that?
I mean, I totally agree with your point. So first off, like, this is the roots of Ludan for me. And it's like Asian male strength is very real. It just doesn't show itself in the ways that is celebrated in the West. It could come through virility. It can come through loyalty. It can come through, you know, physical strength. But for me, so Ludan means grenade or pomegranate bullet, literally translated. But during my parents' generation, and it meant kind of like a dodgy Asian male, like a bum, like your dodgy uncle that kind of smokes too much and drinks too much and gambles too much. He's like that. Like, I remember I was in an Uber and with this Vietnamese Uber driver, and I was like, I asked him what Ludat means. He's like, he's a bum. And for me, so to get back to your point, like, there is a lot of generational trauma about what is Asian masculinity. So we're of the same generation. We grew up at a time where the main Asian role models on screen, visible for everybody, were Mr. Miyagi and Margaret Cho. Like, that was Asian visibility, right? For the longest time, you have this polarizing idea of what is allowed to take up space in mainstream Western media for Asians. It's either the Asian nerd who studies really hard and is really good at math, or is like the kung fu expert that is like blowing shit up, right? Those are the two polar ideas that kind of I grew up with. So I look at Ludan like it's a minority. How do you empower minorities? You form communities around values and you give them space and light to kind of be seen. So for me, there's a lot of work that I've done in terms of like my personal journey. So my personal journey starts from kind of a very small Vietnamese American enclave, protected values in terms of like food, kind of ideas about kind of like Vietnamese culture. We used to go to like temples of and meditate and practice Buddhism, you know, like these very real things. And then kind of as I grew up, I was almost embarrassed of being Asian, right? And there was this real internalized racism. And I talk about internalized racism because I think I almost wanted to reject everything that was Asian because I felt like it was uncool, right? And then fast forward, kind of George, like from good George Floyd, it was this really an unfortunate American tragedy, brought up a lot of issues around identity and race. And I felt like I'd been working in fashion for quite some time, but I had never really dug into these kind of deeper issues. And Ludan, like I said, is like this more minority, but it's also this vehicle for me to celebrate Asian culture. It's a way for me to heal my kind of all those teenage years where I was almost embarrassed to be an Asian. And now it's like coming full circle. It's like cool to be Asian now.
Yeah.
It's like there's so much culture, there's so much history, you know, Asian kind of creativity has been ripped off for centuries. And now we're finally at a place where we can be in front of the camera and be like, this is cool. And like this other guy is doing cool stuff. You know, like Asian tattoo culture has been going on for so long, and you have so many other cultures that have been like taking ownership of it for so long. And it's just an example, you know, of like the kind of creative energy that can come from that soil. Sorry if I drifted a bit.
No, it's very, very part. This is related to your journey and your vision of how Ludang started. So you're going through college as a computer science major. And is that something that you go out and find a job right after college? And where does fashion fit into your life at this stage?
So I think my journey was like, I remember being in, so part of my checkered kind of past. So you have that duality kind of, you know, as an Asian American kid, you know, you have to wear those masks. You have to play a sport. You have to play an instrument. You have to get a good enough amount of grades, or your parents feel like you're an embarrassment to them, and they judge you for that. I never kind of excelled in school in that way, but was good enough to get into college. So I remember sitting in my programming classes and looking around and feeling like I do not fit in here. This is not where I'm going to excel. You know, there's people that are much stronger than me, than what I did. Part of the duality of like of my Asian Americanness was like playing the role of like, okay, I play tennis. Okay, I play guitar, you know, like playing that role for my parents and having them kind of feel like, okay, he's not Ludan. He's not going to be a bum, right? But I was a drug dealer in high school. I was a bookie, you know, so all of this, like, you know, I was into hip hop. I was into kind of heavy metal. So it was almost like this torn kind of identity. It was like, I did enough for my parents to get off my back, and I didn't get enough. I didn't get into so much trouble where they were totally on my case. But, so kind of like a personal thing is like when I was 21, I was a sophomore in college or a junior in college, and I had to go to rehab because that's when like those two worlds collided where I couldn't reconcile, you know, like I couldn't be the good Asian son and still be, you know, like finding myself through kind of like going out and partying and stuff. Part of getting sober was kind of like finding my way and like finishing my degree in computer science was kind of being like making amends to my parents and like, okay, like I do that for you, but now I'm going to kind of try to kind of find my voice through my creativity.
So, wow, that rehab journey is it's a big turning point. And after you graduate and you're done with rehab, how do you begin your work in the fashion business?
So I think this is really interesting because it's like I had no formal art training, like zero. Like
yeah.
I did not draw well. I did not like, I had no creative training. I just knew deep down that I loved communication, nonverbal communication of dress. I knew there was a power to that. And it comes back to that moment, like walking down the hallways in high school and getting kind of positive reinforcement for like dressing cool, right? I knew there was something there that I needed to explore for myself. So I went to community college to start to learn to draw. I took a year off from university and I went to Italy and I went to fashion school. And I went to like a really basic kind of school where you learned how to kind of draw and understand fashion. I went to Parsons for a year in New York and I realized that was not really the fashion that I really wanted to explore. And I got into a school in Antwerp called the Royal Academy of Fine Arts in Belgium, which was really kind of focused on expressing kind of a deeper creative world. And like my contemporary, I don't know how well versed you are in kind of the creative directors of today, but like I was in school with Glenn Martins, who's the creative director for Diesel and Margiela, and I was in school with Demna, who's kind of creative director of former creative director of Balenciaga and now at Gucci. So yeah,
so they were all in various stages at the program in Belgium with you.
Yes. Yes.
So this is not a regular art school, it sounds like.
It's very intense. It's kind of not like, it's, I guess, so the original history of the school is like the Antwerp Six. You have Martin Margiela, you have Dries Van Noten, you have Walter Van Beerdendonk. Raf Simons was around at the time. That was like the kind of the golden age. And then it's kind of a brutal school in terms of like very hardcore fashion training. Like you have about, I don't know, like 500 kids that apply. You have about like, I don't know, 60 that get accepted. And then at the end of 4 years, you have like 8 to 10 students who kind of make it through that rigorous program. And I was the first American to kind of make it.
You know, when I look at runways on Instagram and I see things that are, you know, something that I don't understand, I always wonder from people with the sort of pedigree that you come to the table with, always asking, what are these schools or these environments giving you as an artist that allows you to make decisions that turn out to quote unquote good products, right? Like what is in the training? What is in the water there? The secret sauce that allows you to pump out quote unquote good work, solid work.
I mean, I think school is one thing. School, I think it's interesting because that school is like most of the graduates actually become teachers. like it's I think school prepares you to kind of enter the working world, and it allows you to make connections. This school specifically allows you to nurture a creative vision, and it doesn't necessarily prepare you like other schools to enter the working world. I think this school is special in the sense that it really is a school to train artistic directors, creative directors, that can allow their vision to permeate into everything that they do. A lot of other schools, and not to criticize them, but when you're paying X amount of dollars every year for a higher level education, a lot of other schools prepare you to work in industry. And so I think there's no secret sauce. I think we learn what we can when we go through those experiences. I think that school was very specific in its training because it was so underground when those original kind of creatives came out of it, that it had this folklore that brought a whole generation that really wanted to kind of delve into creativity. I mean, my experience led me after school to Balenciaga, and then after Balenciaga to Celine, and I actually learned a lot more about how to do kind of fashion at the highest level in those places.
Yeah, you say there's no secret sauce, but there's got to be a form or a framework that these people who are leaders in the fashion industry are picking up, right? There's a framework that's established in students there that allow them to function in the highest levels of these journeys. And I'm just digging. I'm like trying to figure out, well, you mentioned other programs. You're not trying to put other programs down. And I understand that, you know, they all have their merits, but at the same time, what does a school like this do differently? You know, is it the way they critique each other's art? Is it the way that the instructors, you know, feed you things that are just out of left field constantly to make you think about the theoretical side of fashion? I mean, what is it that is producing these hard chargers in the fashion business?
I don't know. I mean, I can tell you, I remember in the first year, I had a little mantra, a little drawing that said, no matter what, don't quit, you know? And it was like, fashion is so competitive and there's so little opportunities for people to really express a true creative vision. I think what the school did was allow you to kind of go beyond your limits and push barriers. And I don't think it worked for everybody, but I mean, I do remember, like, it was like, I don't know, about 16, 17 hour work days. And like just hardcore. And I don't know if that's even possible anymore. But at the time it was almost this mentality of like understanding, like, I'm an American minority, an Asian minority in this school, understanding I have to work so much harder because my training is as a computer engineer. I'm such a foreigner to all this. And I didn't excel in school. I barely passed a lot of the years, but I think what I learned was like when there is kind of this creative vision that can filter through everything that you do, it's such a beautiful kind of process. And that's what ends up happening, because you can't, like, as a creative leader, you can't do everything. So you have to create a DNA that, and a vision that other people can follow. And I think that's what you see when you're talking about, like, seeing on the fashion show, because the creative directors, they don't make the clothes, right? But they have to distill a vision that is so clear and pure that it can permeate to everybody that works on it. And then it can be consumed by everybody who sees it on Instagram.
That answer doesn't seem like it can come from somebody who's just getting into the business. That answer seems like you have to do a lot of time in that specific field to answer that. And makes me think, is that something that you thought about right off the bat coming out of, you know, college? It's just such a concept where, you know, I think when we're young, we want to get things out there. But having the deep understanding of creating a clear picture for other people to follow, that's no joke. I think that is something that not everybody, even if you spend a lot of time in it, would be hard too. It would be hard to say, okay, I have an idea of the direction that I want this company to take, and here is the clear ways to do it. How did you form this in the early years? How did you go about learning your trade in the early years and coming up with this understanding that you're going to have a direction one day for the brand?
I think it came over time. I don't think I had, because when you're in school and you're like you said, you're young, you're ambitious, and you're creative, you want to do everything yourself, right? And if you look at, like, kind of like CEOs or kind of like leaders of bigger organizations, like it's team culture, right? It's like, how do I get, like what I'm really into today is, like, how do I design the team to kind of get the most out of them and have them understand so I can direct. It's like it's fascinating, because fashion brands have a very visible DNA, right? And it's like what are the key words that allow that to happen? What are the values that you want to share? And it's not that everybody has the same values. Some people can express, you know, the vision more visually, and some express it more with words, and some express it more with creative business decisions, you know. And it's really, like, what I'm really focused on. And to get back to your question, it wasn't something that I've really understood till more recently. I've been a part of these major fashion moments where you just feel the energy is such that it's like everybody's pushing each other forward. It's like you're just inspired to be in the room, because there's such creativity happening at all levels where it's like, it's so cool to be a part of. So what I'm trying to do with my structure now is, how do I build that? How do I nurture that? How do I design? How do I put, like, my skill sets and nurture a creative vision that allows the team to be at their highest level? Sometimes it's putting their feet on the fire. Sometimes it's encouraging them for their work. But the strength of what I'm trying to build is not just going to be from me. It's going to be from, how can everybody on the team be the strongest member of Luden that they can?
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most. Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Big shout out to you for making it through the hectic holiday season. This new year, get clean, quality, pregnancy nutrient support off your to-do list, including Ritual's best-selling essential prenatal multivitamin, designed with 12 traceable key ingredients to support a healthy pregnancy. With big changes coming up, take the small steps now and start today with 30% off a 3-month supply at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So before you opened up Ludyne, you were working at other fashion houses. And when did the official sort of like, I'm doing this, I'm going full time into Ludyne and growing my brand? Can you tell me the period leading up to that moment, what life was like and what the journey was like for you?
So Ludyne celebrated his third anniversary on January 30th. So Ludyne was launched January 30th, 2022. So it's just a little over 3 years old. So I think like all of my experiences before Ludyne was kind of the fertilizer, the soil that allowed it to kind of grow into what it is today. Asian American growing up, an American in the 80s, you know, duality of kind of mixed, like Asian at home and then American in school culture. High school with kind of like not feeling like a minority, feeling different, not fitting in, you know, computer science, you know, like engineering, not fitting in there, finding my way through kind of, you know, art school, design school, getting myself into good jobs and, you know, like understanding how like fashion works in high level fashion, women's wear fashion in these houses. After that, I have a women's wear brand that I launched with my partner, Leia Dickely. We've had that for, I think, 9 years. It's called Quiet Ann Editions. And we were working on that diligently during COVID, understanding like that small structure was really difficult. And I think like the soil that kind of launched Ludyne was it was basically came from the seed of this idea, like I'd always designed for women, which I'm not, and more for a Western audience, which doesn't speak specifically to me. So I thought, I've never worked around like from my parents' generation's mentality. It's like, why would you work around something personal or something kind of Asian? You would want to design more for a bigger demographic.
Yeah,
I thought, I've never done something personal in my work. I've had this hardcore training at Antwerp. I've understood what it means to kind of create fashion at houses like Balenciaga and Celine, but I'd never done something personal, right? I was like, what if I use my own personal journey and apply that to fashion? And I feel like there was so many kind of moments where I was like, no one's ever talked about this guy. No one ever shines light or add stories with depth about this dodgy Asian man that is so colorful. That's actually really cool, but everybody kind of makes fun of.
You know, I love your brand identity. I think it's a cool name. And I understand Lu Dang to mean many things that are sort of the things that you defined it at early in the podcast, but also Lu Dang is like, when I think of Lu Dang, it's like my equivalent to it is when somebody says, "Oh, that's gangster," right? In my mind, my street translation, the colloquial for Lu Dang is like, "당연히 Lu Dang 람," like that's a gangster. He's a gangster, and we don't mean like gangs participating in gangs, but we're talking about this sort of mentality of, you know, he's wilding out. He thinks differently, but it's usually attributed to men, but it could also be used to refer to women as well. How did you, get sort of received when you first came up with the brand identity?
I love how you kind of put that. I mean, I love that kind of translation of it being gangster, because I think that's something that we love to kind of celebrate, and it's almost like a transformation, because like when your mom is saying, "Oh, tangna luda," it's almost a badge of shame, right? And then when we use it, it's almost like transformation. It's like, he's fucking Lu Dang. You know, it's almost like he's gangster, right? And it's like, he's got his own swag. He's got his own attitude. He doesn't need to conform to kind of very safe, like Asian stereotypes. And like the question that you originally asked is, how do we come up with, or one of the original questions was, how do we come up with the name? So I wanted to have something a little bit unusual for the name. And we went through many different iterations. One of them was Nyakwe. But because I just remember how much shame my mom would have, like, Tangdala Nyakwe, you know? And I was like, it just didn't work. So I was ideating on kind of the name, and I was asking my parents. And my dad was like, "I got a good name for you. It's Lu Dang."
Oh, wow.
And it was like this really beautiful kind of like familial moment of like, because I wanted something that we could re-own in a way.
Reclaim.
The reclaim. Absolutely. And it's... Oh, I forgot the point that I was going to make. What was your so question?
You were talking about how you came up with it. Your father gave you the name of it, and you know, I wanted to hear how it was received initially in the beginning.
So, one of the most beautiful things that I've kind of accepted about this journey of Lu Dang is that Lu Dang is a Vietnamese word, right? But brands have a really powerful way of transmitting their brand name. So you have people like Billie Eilish saying a Vietnamese word. You have people like Justin Bieber and SZA and Kendrick Lamar saying Lu Dang. And so for me, there's a beauty to putting a Vietnamese word into the lexicon of all these really big stars and athletes, you know? So on one hand, I think that, I don't know what people thought. Like, I think it sits in this place of like, it's not too foreign. It's something people can say like pretty easily. So I think people might have been drawn to kind of the accents in the name, and that it was something kind of exotic and foreign. I don't know how it was received, to answer your question. Like, I think I was always kind of explaining what the word meant in Vietnamese and what it meant in colloquial like slang. But I don't know how it was received, but I do feel really empowered that I feel like I've put a Vietnamese kind of word on the lips of kind of very important people.
I'll tell you how I reacted in the beginning when I first heard it. I was like, this must be a designer out of Vietnam. I thought that to understand the language on that level, it had to be somebody who really got the language really, really well and understood the direction of where he's going to take this. And I had imagined that for a long time. And not until today, really, that it, I think my bias is it completely washed away, because, you know, you're a Vietnamese American now living in London, and you know, seeing the word, for me, the impact of that word on the celebrities and the stars that I've seen it, you know, these stars wearing your clothes, it shakes me to the core as a Vietnamese person living overseas. You know, it really makes me feel really good. And I want to ask you, what is the journey to get these stars and these people to wear the brand and to say it?
I don't know. I mean, it's another like secret sauce for me. Like, for me, I hustle, you know, I'm like, I know the value of creating a powerful world and a message. And I feel so blessed because there's so much colorful culture that I can touch, you know, that I feel is specific to the brand identity, you know? And I feel like I'm so lucky in that regards. I mean, I guess I've had the privilege to be in certain rooms at certain times that have allowed me access to certain stylists that have opened the door for certain situations. But for me, it's like, I think it's a testament of the work of the identity of the brand that people are drawn to it. Like Billie Eilish, she's a bad boy, right? Ludam is about bad boys, right? Like it's a testament to kind of the world that we've been building that allows these people to be like, I want to be a part of this. Because brands don't make clothes in a vacuum. It's not like there's a product and that I want this product. People are consuming kind of the dream, the identity of the world, where it's like, oh, this is the visual imagery. This is the music that this brand likes. These are the people that are associated with this brand. This is, you know, it's cultivating all those elements as a creative, you know, that's like direction, right? It's allowing, you know, it's like, oh, this person is interesting. I'm influenced with them. I want to work with them. You know, I want to send them some clothes. I want to see how they interact and how like their stories to be told through the interaction with certain people.
In 3 years, you've done that much, but I can imagine that there is also a pressure to innovate. But is there for somebody like you, or do you just sort of have so many ideas that the pressure is not really there? It's just the pressure to execute and not really to innovate on design.
I wish I could say that there was no pressure. I think fashion, the state of fashion, the best description that I've heard was from a PR that I used to work with. And he said, fashion is always late and never enough. So you're always working from a point of deficiency. Like you're only as good as your last collection. So there's always pressure to kind of up the ante. Where I do feel like I'm lucky is that it's fun and it's easy for me to come up with creative ways to kind of express the vision of the brand. We just came back from Paris. We did an event and it's kind of based off of, I don't know, like what kind of community you grew up in K-Town, but like the weekend community of Vietnamese that I grew up with, like the way that they partied was like, we would go to someone's house over the weekend. There would be about 20 females, women, cooking in the kitchen, like exquisite, like bún bò Huế, bánh cuốn, you know, like bún thịt nướng. Like you would have like an insane spread of food. The men would be gambling, mahjong, poker, sap sam, you know, like the kids would be running around. There would be a moment where everything stopped, everyone would eat, we would do karaoke, you know, it would just be like all these different pleasures and desires. So in Paris last week or 2 weeks ago, I threw a hot pot party. Mm-hmm. So it was called it was hot pot. It was karaoke. It was ping pong. It was mahjong. I had a masseuse there. There was a claw game where you could get t-shirts, and it was really like trying to kind of recreate this moment when I was a kid of like these parties that my parents would throw. And it was like so many things going on, so many different cauldrons of culture just bubbling up. And it was like, I don't know if other culture, did you kind of ever go to kind of these, like, and food was always a star. Yeah. Right?
It's good memories. But I think you called it not your mom's hot pot.
No, I called it not your mom's potluck.
Oh, not your mom's potluck. That's a cool name.
But it was a way of celebrating the culture that I grew up with.
Yeah. And it's it continues to actually happen today, I think, in many households across the diaspora and in Vietnam, obviously, that, yeah, it's a normal thing. It's just, I think Vietnamese is a very warm and lively culture. We like to engage with each other. We like to be around each other a lot.
Yeah.
What has been the most challenging aspect of the work that you do?
I think, you know, like being like a creative director, you have to wear so many hats. Sometimes it's the CEO hat. Sometimes it's the collection director hat. Sometimes it's like, I've been really focused on kind of building the team, you know. It's almost like you have to wear so many hats and you have to be strong at all of them. But what I guess my school training taught me is like, if you have that creative vision to lead everybody, that allows things. So I guess the challenge is like being like an entrepreneur. It's like one day I'm like trying to solve shipping issues, and the next day I'm working on the team, and the next day I'm trying to figure out like what I want to express in the collections. And I guess like I've learned to be able to wear a lot of hats. And I think like sometimes it's frustrating because sometimes I feel like I don't want to wear that hat. But when it's so personal and when it's yours, it's like, it's almost like your family. It's like, you're going to suit up and show up and do kind of what needs to be done. So it's like, it's very competitive brand world. There's so much kind of competition for resources, for shops, you know, it's not for the faint of heart. But if you do, like for all those kind of young kids that really want to do fashion, if you do have a vision that you want to express, if you do kind of want to create worlds that communities can form around, it can be very kind of fruitful and rewarding.
Speaking of community, why and how did you end up in London?
So the journey was like, I was in New York, I was in school, I got into Antwerp, I was there in Antwerp for 4 years, and then I went to Paris. And then my partner got a job at Alexander McQueen. So I went to work at Celine because I wanted to work with Phoebe Philo for a couple years. And we've just stayed in London. And it's interesting because I'm like, I haven't lived in America since 2004.
Wow.
So over
20 years.
Over 20 years, yeah.
My brother has been living in Vietnam since 2004. And do you miss it?
I miss my family. I mean, America is a crazy place. I love it and I hate it. Like, the politics are kind of all over the place these days. And it's kind of like, it's sometimes better to see from afar, but I always feel kind of rooted in this kind of, I say that I'm Vietnamese born in America. I used to say that I was Vietnamese American. Now I say that I'm Vietnamese born in America because I feel like America will always be part of my journey because it was so formative. It's where I spent the first 23 years of my life. But I feel like there's a part of my Vietnamese identity that I'm embracing more and more. But I don't want to forget that American part. I mean, most of my family still is in America. So I go 2 or 3 times a year.
Yeah. And do you follow Vietnamese designers, fashion designers in Vietnam or coming out of Vietnam?
There's a couple that are doing really well, like Peter Doe. I'm friends with. We were actually at Celine together. There's a really cool women's wear brand called Fancy Club that I'm in contact with. There's a lot. You know what is really interesting, Kenneth? There's a lot of very strong, successful Vietnamese creatives, but I feel like there's got to be a moment where we come together more and we kind of join forces.
Because I think about that very often. We make so much garments that are being shipped all over the world. We can make things. We can make shoes. We can make clothes. But when will the brands that are led by Vietnamese people make it out to the real world at a high level, you know? And I agree with you. Joining up and collaborating and working together, I hope that that is inevitable. But I would also like to see the birth of more Ludan brands like yours that reach the highest levels. And so I'm always curious about, you know, well, we can make these things, but what is missing in the equation to actually be the brand?
I mean, I think like Vietnam, like I'm in touch with a lot of the kids back there and I have a lot of friends. It's been a long time since I've been back, but I'm kind of through social media in touch with a lot of kind of the young kids there. And I see the energy in Vietnam as kind of yearning to be seen. And it's like, I always look at kind of like creative moments, almost like people, right? Like Vietnam's creativity is like, it's nascent. It's like preteen. It's like bubbling and it wants to reach the rest of the world, but it just hasn't matured enough to kind of be seen on that level. Cause I've done a couple interviews for like L'Officiel and Elle Vietnam, and they're always asking me as a Vietnamese creative that's been pretty successful kind of in the West, is like how can local Vietnamese designers be more seen? And I feel like it's really a moment of coming together. I feel like it's a really a moment of maturation. You know, it's like you can have all the desire in the world. It's like when the conditions are right, it will manifest, right? When the soil and the sun, when all the elements are there, it'll manifest. I think how we can accelerate that is if we come together as community, if we show kind of collectively, like how we can express our creativity collectively.
And going forward and looking back, where do you think you'll land in terms of how you want to be received in the world as a fashion designer?
That's a tough question. I don't know if I have an answer for that. Like I have really big ambitions for the brand. I really see a lot of potential, and I see the opportunity to kind of one heal, like not even heal, but like to reach so many young kids. And the way that I see it is like our generation, you know, is creating the space for future generations to be seen and heard in different ways, so that future generations don't have to be like, oh, there were no cool Asian motherfuckers, you know, doing fashion, like for you know, the generations that follow. So it's our responsibility to almost like break down those barriers and allow kind of Asians to be in positions of power that are able to kind of set agendas, you know, to speak to all the kids, you know. So I mean, I don't think I can put words on where I want to take this thing. It's just at the beginning, and I really see a lot of kind of potential to kind of really create a tribe that really feels like they're included in the world that I'm building.
You know, I think the world is in turmoil economically. I think industries like film and food has been hit really hard. I don't know the fashion industry well enough, but I wanted to ask you, is there differences in sort of like the everyday clothes that we wear versus the brands that are at your level where you're not really affected by the significant changes in the world's economy today?
No, I think all luxury, I'll call them luxury industries, because you have your basic needs like food, water, shelter that I always think will kind of take priority. But like, I feel like all luxury has been hit. Like all the major kind of fashion houses are reporting gains, not as much, or losses kind of on their bottom lines. And I think it's really a difficult moment in terms of like people's resources aren't as deep in order in terms of buying fashion as they have been in the past. And to that point, I feel like we're fortunate because we are growing, and we're just getting stronger. We're getting stronger in the shadows. While the world heals, and when that time comes, we're going to be better for it.
Cool. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with me. And, I'm very happy to hear that last question being answered the way you did.
I'm honored to be on to share this space with you, Kenneth. I really feel like one of the things that feeds me the most is when I have time to kind of connect with Asian creatives and share the journey, because I feel like we're so not alone, and the more that we can spread the word and share how important our stories are, the more the world will react and understand like this journey is cultured, it's nuanced, it's beautiful, it's specific, and the more that we're able to connect with each other, the more power that will be. And one last thing, because I know you have a question of what's next. I'm really working towards a big moment in Vietnam. I would like to really connect with the kids and to come home and really do something big in Vietnam in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I'd like to have you back on the podcast to talk about, you know, that when you come back. I would want to check in with all my guests, you know.
Of course. Let's do it.
Every year or every other year, you know, I welcome that. If you have new things that you want to talk about, even in a few months, if you have some cool stuff that you want to really talk about and put it out there, this is the place. I'd love for you to hit me up.
Yeah, I appreciate the time and the space, Kenneth. It's really, really considered and thoughtful.
Thank you, Hung. Talk to you soon.
Kevin.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.